we'd both spent a bunch of time at Andreessen and all of this. So they were like one of the few funds that was actually building out a fintech practice at the time. I actually sat in on your pitch meeting many years ago.
You were in the meeting, huh?
I was in that room, one of the 45 people
we
sitting there.
We packed that conference room.
Yeah. Wow, and then Ramp started right after. How'd that work? No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding, Ramp team. Just chill out.
So, talking to Sheil and Jake today, who are the founders of Better Tomorrow Ventures. Both of them come from a highly entrepreneurial background, started multiple companies, NerdWallet being one of the notable companies that Jake co-founded. And these are perfect people for who we're talking about because they've lived every principle that they're now practicing as an investor.
One of the things we think a lot about is, as an investor, how can you help founders and manufacture your own returns? And we get to talk a lot about that with Jake and Sheil today. One quick thing to note, BTV has recently announced their own accelerator. So kind of like, think of an alternative to Y Combinator, but specifically for fintech companies. They call it the Mint. And we talk about it a little bit in the podcast, but I do highly recommend any fintech founder who is thinking about starting something should go apply to the Mint. We're actually in the Mint offices in San Francisco right now. Jake and Sheil have put together a great cohort of learnings, trainings. Sterling and I act as kind of like, advisors?
We've been able to do office hours for the Mint.
Think very highly of it. Anyone thinking about it should go apply.
Tyler and I have talked about how much smarter it would have made us a lot earlier. It would have done a lot less stupid things. So it's definitely something worth checking out for the fintech folks out there.
I think particularly any fintech founder or operator is going to love this conversation.
Absolutely.
For people listening to the podcast who maybe aren't on Twitter, don't know both of you, let's get to know you both a little bit. So why don't we start with Sheil? Sheil, can you give us just a quick background of yourself, 500 startups, the other things you've done? You've been a founder.
Yeah.
Tell us a little about yourself, then we'll go to Jake.
Sure. I grew up in Pittsburgh, spent most of my early life there. Where I'm from in India, Rajasthan, is known to be like where the business people come from. And it's kind of run in my family too. Like, everyone was a business person of some type. My grandfather on my mom's side, like, he would read about something in the newspaper and be like, oh, this is the future, I'm gonna start a company. So he started a TV manufacturing company, making like originally black and white and color TVs when TV was getting started in India. He started this like payphone company making payphones. Anyway, so I've always been interested in business and knew that I wanted to do it after college. But I started out working in software, first Cerner, healthcare software company, then was a management consultant, and then ultimately decided to leave to help a friend start a company. That was a payments company called Fee Fighters, acquired.
First touch into fintech was there, it sounds like.
Yeah, actually, you could argue that my first touch in fintech was earlier on the nonprofit side.
Got it.
Kiva. Kiva is a website that lets...
Microloans?
Microfinance. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it lets you, in the US or anywhere, make a loan to somebody in the developing world for the sake of alleviating poverty. That was crazy. I was, you know, getting on a bus and then on the back of a motorcycle just to serve a single borrower, realize how inefficient it is and why APRs are so high for poor people. Then went to BCG, served financial institutions, Fee Fighters, payments company, got acquired by Groupon at really peak Groupon heyday.
I remember.
The stock price went up $600 million when they announced that they acquired us for a way, way, way smaller sum. After that company got acquired, 500 startups who had invested in the first company said, hey, why don't you come help out and mentor?
So that was your transition into investing, was 500 startups?
Yeah. I had been doing a bunch of angel investing prior to that, but really full time, it started end of 2015, beginning of 2016. And I decided to start a fintech specific cohort of 500 startups, the accelerator. And I just had such a blast doing it. I loved helping companies at the earliest stages. It's brings me a lot of joy, and it's actually different. Investing in an accelerator stage is actually even different than seed stage investing, because you're like really in it when they're figuring things out in the office every day. And so I loved it, wanted to keep doing it. Jake and I met early on in that tenure. He had co-founded NerdWallet, and company I'd always looked up to, and he was doing some angel investing. So I said, you know, why don't you come look at our companies? He came in, companies loved meeting him, and he invested in a bunch of the companies. And then I asked him to join me, said, hey, will you help me do this? And
at 500 startups.
At 500 startups.
Okay, got it. Jake, tell us the NerdWallet story. How did you start
it? And before you start, on the elevator down this morning, somebody was talking about NerdWallet.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's just one of those things that everyone knows the brand. It's such a widespread resource that many people have gotten value out of.
Yeah, it's great. And it never gets old to hear those stories. And we spend a lot of money on brand marketing these days also. So even my son, he gets to see us like on NBA games and NFL games and stuff like that. And he's very excited. And he tells all his friends when they come over for playdates and stuff, did you know my dad is a founder of NerdWallet? I don't even think these other kids have any idea what that means.
Sounds nerdy.
Or even know what a founder is, really. But I'll take a step back. Mine and Shiel's lives have actually kind of run in parallel, very different at some points and very similar at other points. But I grew up in Atlanta. I did not come from a family of entrepreneurs. I ended up becoming an entrepreneur mostly to get away from all of that, to get away from Atlanta and get away from kind of where I grew up, and had very high ambitions and was also not very manageable as an employee.
Unemployable.
Exactly. So I studied, and then I was also always into money. So not having had any growing up, I was always just like obsessed with the concept of money. And so I went to MIT and studied. I double majored in math and quantitative finance. I got really excited about finance while I was at MIT. Originally thought I was going to go into computer science and go into tech, but I just got seduced by the Wall Street side of things. I ended up working on a interest rate derivatives prop desk out of college, and did that through the financial crisis and into like 2010, basically at JP Morgan. And then at that time, one of my buddies who I'd grown up with in Atlanta started working on what was going to become NerdWallet, because he had gotten laid off from the hedge fund that he was working at in 2008, as a lot of people did. He had just been like traveling around the world, and he had this idea for NerdWallet, and he starts banging away on an EPC, reteaching himself how to code, like building out the first iterations of the website and the first iterations of the business model. And I joined on with him shortly thereafter, not so much because I had like a great idea or like a passion for credit cards per se, but because that experience working on Wall Street kind of told me that I didn't love working for other people, especially in a culture where your whole job is to make those other people rich, and you're not building anything of value. You don't own anything per se. You're not helping anybody. I decided I wanted to move to California and build something. I had all these friends that were starting companies, like Drew from Dropbox is a college buddy of mine, and I would see him on TechCrunch and stuff like that and be like, God damn it, why am I not doing that?
I think we all did that with Drew back then.
Yeah, exactly. Not that I could have done that, but it was like there was something so inspiring about seeing that as I'm on my iPhone on the trading floor, like hating my job. And so ultimately decided to leave and go start something. Tim was working on NerdWallet, and I just jumped on with him initially just to help out part time and just thinking like this will be a learning experience while I figure out what I want to do with my life. But I got very quickly sucked in and kind of seduced by like just building and like being creative. And again, also retaught myself how to code, had to like learn all this marketing stuff from scratch and PR stuff from scratch and like web development and all these things. And it was just fun, like working together, even if I didn't care so much about credit cards per se. It was me and Tim pretty much solo for a couple of years there. I moved out to California. He was still working from New York. Eventually he made his way out to California, and it was the two of us working out of a closet of a co-working space in Redwood City.
When did it start taking off? Like when did it turn into something real?
That's actually a fun story because So we had this idea that, like, if you looked at, like, the bank rates of the world, or like creditcards.com, and, you know, back in 2010, like, that was the premier in terms of, like, financial advice online, were those sorts of websites. And, you know, we would look at these and be like, these websites haven't been redesigned since the 90s. Like, we now live in a world where we're all starting to have, like, iPhones and stuff like that. And we're all using Kayak and things to search for websites. Like, why are we just going and clicking on billboards basically to get credit cards and other financial products? And then they were making a shit ton of money just from, like, SEO, basically. Like, your name is creditcards.com. You rank number one for every credit card search. And Bankrate had literally been around since the 70s. They'd been online since the 90s. So naturally, they ranked highly for everything as well. But we're like, why do they deserve to be, like, the top search? If somebody's actually looking for information on credit cards, like, this is probably the worst place to get that advice from. Why do they get to be number one? So we decided that we were going to build a better product, kind of take this idea of, like, the Kayaks and stuff of the world back then, where you could kind of customize what you were looking for and get something tailored to you. But then also beat these guys at the SEO game. And the reason it was just me and Tim for a while is we didn't think anybody would give us money to go out and do that.
It wasn't really a venture back thing to start. You're just building a website.
I mean, we were literally an LLC at this point. No, we were not. We didn't view ourselves as, like, a venture backable thing. But what we kind of saw going on in the market was there were all these websites out there trying to game Google. Yeah. Like, let's try to outsmart Google. Let's reverse engineer the algorithm. And just try to, like, hyper optimize our websites for what we think the robot wants. And we decided, like, that robot's going to get smarter. Like, there's thousands of PhDs down there in Mountain View that are trying to solve this problem. And the problem they're trying to solve is not, like, what are the exact inputs and what are the exact outputs. The problem they're trying to solve is you as an end user, when you ask a natural language question about credit cards, they want to give you the best answer to that question. So hyper optimizing for what the algorithm is today seemed like a loser's game long term.
Yeah.
And so we took the approach of, let's just write good content. Let's write stuff that people want to read, that people want to share. And by doing so, like, people will link to us, people will share us, and then ultimately, like, that will benefit us, and Google will reward us for that. And again, it took longer than we thought it would. When we really started to take off was in 2011. Google rolled out a bunch, like, back-to-back aggressive algorithm changes intentionally to solve this problem, like, wiping out the search
span. So you
were
right. The bot got smarter.
We were just about to throw in the towel, and all of our theses up to that point became true, like, literally overnight. It was like one day we had zero revenue. The next day we woke up and we're like, what the fuck is going on? Like, our traffic was through the roof. And I think, like, the first 6 to 9 months of 2011, we'd made maybe $50,000 in revenue, and we made, like, $1.5 million in the back half of that year, and it was still just the two of us, and that was, you know, that was the whole NerdWallet team. And then after that, it was like, oh shit, maybe we should start actually acting like a startup now. Maybe we should start hiring people. Maybe we should set our ambitions higher, and build out much more of a kind of take the playbook and build out much more of a personal finance advice platform.
Fascinating. So would you say the insight there that maybe the market hadn't yet figured out was, don't play the SEO optimization thing, just build valuable content and you'll be rewarded. Is that fair?
That was the essence of it.
And the reason I ask is because it does feel like every startup has some secret that they've figured out, and that sounds like it might have been yours, and I'm curious if you agree.
Yeah, so I think there were kind of two big decisions we made early on that kind of set the whole business up for success. And that was one of them. And the reason we made that, part of the reason we made that decision, Matt Cutts at Google was the head of search spam at the time. And he was a very familiar name to those of us who were building companies at that time, because he was on YouTube every day answering questions that people would email in about SEO.
Got it.
And it didn't matter what the questions were, always like people trying to ask about very specific details of the algorithm. And the answer was always the same. If you make quality content, we will find you.
Yeah.
He said the same thing every day, day in and day out. So we were like, obviously this is their goal. That might not be where they are today, but that's where they're going. And so that's what we optimized for. The other decision was just starting when we did. Like, we started in the depths of the financial crisis, when there weren't a lot of people going after this space because the banks weren't spending money on marketing. Mm-hmm. They weren't trying to acquire new credit card customers because they weren't lending. And so even during the times when we were just screwing up everything we possibly could, the company still grew, because coming out of that, that market just exploded. And so there were years where our traffic didn't grow at all, but Amex and Chase were fighting so hard for market share that like our revenue per user or revenue per visitor or whatever was still growing. And so our growth curve looked pretty good even in the years when we weren't doing great as a company just because of the market.
Very cool.
So similar question to the NerdWallet story here. What did you learn multiple time founder about those first customers, that first revenue, like how to go from zero to one? And did you get better at it throughout, or was it kind of a mixture of just product market fit and the pull? Like, what did you learn there?
I learned that, early on, it's the founder doing whatever the hell they can to get customers. And it's how you realize early on, like in the accelerator we have, you realize like the founders that just do whatever it takes to get those first customers are the ones that you need to back. For Fee Fighters, it was really like getting a lot of press, getting out there as much as possible, calling everyone I knew that owned a business. It was a lot of that kind of stuff. For Innovative Auctions, we had a totally different business model that's a lot to explain, but we had a finite number of potential customers in the world. There were about 200, and we had to get in front of all of them. And one fun story my co-founder loves telling, told this at my wedding actually, is there was this one customer we really need to get in front of, and they weren't responding to any emails, anything, nothing I could do to get in front of them. So I went to a conference. I like had his picture memorized. I found him, and then I saw that he was a smoker, and I bought a pack of cigarettes and I started smoking outside with him.
Do you smoke?
I do not smoke. I hate smoking. And
hey, whatever it takes.
And we got them ultimately as a customer.
That's amazing.
So you got to just be willing to do whatever it takes to get those early customers.
Years off your life.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a small price to pay. Yeah. It is a fascinating common thread between the startups that ultimately find success and product market fit is that brute force, like whatever it is, or that bet that seems ludicrous at the time that ultimately ends up getting you the traction you need to make it a real business. So
guerrilla tactics like that as well with our content marketing, because it wasn't just writing credit card reviews all day. Like we needed to get eyeballs. Like we knew pretty early on, like if you build it, they will come was just, malarkey. So we needed to do anything and everything we could to get people to pay attention to this, tiny little website. And so not only were we writing content for ourselves, but we also like went on the offense and were writing pretty controversial is not the right word. We were being like pretty aggressive with kind of the content marketing and stuff that we were going after, including one time I want to say it was like the St. Louis Fed or somebody wrote a research report about credit card rewards and how they were like bad for the poor. And we went through the research report and like broke down all of their math and wrote our own report on why it was all wrong. Yeah. And we ended up getting published in the New York Times because of that. And the St. Louis Fed issued a correction. they did not go back on their overall findings, but they definitely reduced the weight of them. Yeah. And we had things where like, there were all these scams that were popping up around that time where we would go out and we'd find these like prepaid debit card scams and stuff. And we'd go out and bring them down. It's like the kind of thing that seems like a waste of time for you to be focusing on, but it's what made us at the end of the day, those sorts of things.
All right. So you two end up finding a connection at 500 Startups, which eventually leads to BTV. So can one of you tell the story of like, hey, you probably have a conversation of let's go do our own fund at some point. How'd you get to conviction on that? Talk us through the founding story of BTV and give everyone here a kind of the background.
Also, how did that experience at 500 Startups inform the way that you wanted to do that? What did you learn from that experience that kind of put the foundational ideas of BTV in your heads?
Yeah, 500, it was a great jumping off point for me in particular. But I think there were a lot of things that they were doing that wasn't how I wanted to do business. And so we knew we were going to leave. So I was a partner at that point. Jake was an EIR, but really acting kind of like my partner already at that point. And but we had a fund to run there, so it had to run its course, even though there I wanted to leave a little bit earlier. We both ended up interviewing with a bunch of other firms. We actually didn't necessarily know that we wanted to start a fund together. We thought, let's talk to everyone else. And so we both interviewed with a bunch of multi-stage firms that you guys know the names of. And we were interviewing for the same jobs, really. So we were like competing against each other in one way, but.
Or interviewing for the same non-jobs in a lot of cases. Yeah. They're like, hey, do you need a fintech partner? No. Okay.
But it would be like, you know, he would interview for somebody who needed a fintech partner and say, oh, like, you shouldn't just talk to me. You should talk to Sheila too. It was really like not a competitive thing, which is not what you'd expect. But we were just, we actually became better friends through that process. And then ultimately decided, actually, what we want to do, what we love doing, is helping companies at the earlier stages. And it's probably, we're probably like too entrepreneurial to go into like, some of these other places felt like a job. Like you're going into somebody else's thing and you're doing the same thing over and over again that they tell you to do. We felt like maybe we were too entrepreneurial for that and we didn't need a job. We wanted like to build something.
Okay. So how do you go? Who's your first LPs? Who did you get to believe first off to build this fund?
How many of them were crossovers from the 500 startups fund that you were running?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when we started kind of having these conversations, talking to each other about starting this fund, like our biggest concern was everybody's telling us there's 1,000 seed funds out there that are fundraising right now.
Yep.
And
this is like peak almost. There's getting to be peak.
Totally.
Man, those were the days.
A little bit before peak. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like 2019. There was a blow off top after that kind of 2020 and 2021, but like still pretty crowded market. So we didn't feel justified going out there unless we had like a real kind of differentiated story, differentiated strategy. And it was actually Sheil who one day was like, you know, we've effectively been leading rounds and like pre-seed fintech for the past couple of years with 500 fintechs. We actually have to like convince these founders to do our program and to take less money than they otherwise could raise. And a lot of times these are really credentialed operators and founders. Like we've actually already been doing this work and we've seen that there's a gap in the early stage for fintech. Because we'd go on and like try to help these companies fundraise and they'd have a hard time because there just weren't enough investors out there
focused in fintech,
Exactly. And actually understood the business models and things like that. And so there's clearly a gap to fill. And so that kind of helped us formulate the story and get more conviction around wanting to start. And then, you know, your other question was like, who are our first LPs? And funny enough, we'd both spent a bunch of time at Andreessen and all of this. So they were like one of the few funds that was actually building out a fintech practice at the time. And they hadn't decided yet how many partners they wanted or if they wanted to hire new partners or bring them up internally or whatever. But they were still spending a lot of time with us. We were in partner meetings. We met with Mark a bunch. We sat in a lot of pitch meetings, all that stuff. I actually sat in on your pitch meeting
I at was there
many years ago.
You were in the meeting, huh?
I was in that room, one of the 45 people
we
sitting there.
We packed that one conference room.
Yeah. Wow, and then Ramp started right after. How did that work? I'm just kidding. Just kidding, Ramp team. Just chill out. Thanks a lot, Jake.
I was in that room. I was one of the many, many people sitting in the windowsills. So we'd both spent a lot of time with that team. But then ultimately decided we were going to do our own thing. And so I went in to tell Alex Rempel and then ultimately to tell Mark that we were going to go our own way. And he goes, congratulations. And I was like, yeah, we don't have a name. we don't have docs. We don't have any LPs. Like, don't congratulate us just yet. He goes, no, I'm not congratulating you on the fund. I'm congratulating you on making the right decision. So he was pretty clear that you guys need to be building, not working for somebody else. And then he committed on the spot.
That's awesome.
And so he and Chris Dixon, who invest together into funds, were our first LP.
And ultimately LPs. A lot of other Andreessen partners committed.
Yeah, and then basically like the entire fintech practice invested in us as well.
Wow, very cool. Man, so you have their backing and then it's just to the races after that point to go get the docs and everything's easy.
Yeah, but it was not easy.
Yeah, I wish.
Talk about that. How hard was it raising this first fund? How big was the first fund?
Sure. So Sterling, you asked if the 500 startups folks came in. Yeah. They all, I believe all of them came in.
Awesome.
It was but that entire fund was $15 million. And when we started BTV, we thought we would do $60 million. And one interesting fact is before we built our first deck, before we had finalized the name, which actually took a long time.
The name was not even finalized long after the document.
Yeah. Sorry. We actually had committed to our first deal. So we committed to a deal, and it was a big one. It's a company called Unit, mm-hmm. banking as a yep. service company. We committed to leading their seed round in, I think it was September of 2019. Hmm. And that's later that month, we started fundraising for the fund.
That's amazing.
And then...
Did that help with fundraising, actually having a deal you were already excited about?
I think so, because
there's something... It helped more after we actually wired the money, but...
Yeah. But, yeah, I think it was something we could talk about, and it was a big part of our thesis is the world of fintech today is going to be different than the world tomorrow, and Unit...
Is going to drive that.
Is going to drive a part of that, and that really played out pretty well.
Yeah. Yep.
So...
Decent bet there.
So that helped us a lot. Our first close on what was going to be a $60 million fund, first close was in December. It was, I think, $18.6 million. And it was an interesting time. A lot of folks that backed us were like fintech entrepreneurs or people that knew us already. Mm-hmm. It was hard to get anyone new to be that interested, but we did have one fund of funds, Sendana, backed us in that first close. And it was... fairly easy for us to get to that first $18.6 million because
it's a lot of like friends and family money, broadly written. Yeah.
To be clear, no family money, but
friends and friends,
like people we used to work with, like with my Wall Street connection.
Family of a different kind. Yeah. Co-founders, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then, okay, we were like, all right, now what's up next? We'll get to a close. We had targeted this date. March 30th, 2020. So we're like,
nice.
Yeah. So we're like working, you know, the beginning of 2020, we're meeting with a bunch of people, all this stuff. Things are looking fairly good for another close in March. We even have folks sign documents and everything. And then we do our first ever road trip to fundraise. Mm-hmm. We go out to the East Coast. I think it was like March 9th or something like that. And we go to Philly, Baltimore, New York. And on the way out there, everything's normal. On the way back.
Not normal.
Not normal at all. The NBA.
And Jake was sick. Everything. He was coughing. And,
we came back on a completely empty flight.
We went out on a packed red eye to Philly, like literally overflowing with people on like a 4-hour red eye flight. And came back on one of those giant, like, Newark to San Francisco planes.
Empty.
Completely empty.
There were 20 people on the plane.
Wow.
And so folks who had committed, signed documents, backed out. Mm-hmm. Folks who we thought were, like, going to be anchors, like, stopped responding to our messages. Yep. It was a tough time.
Go ahead.
We had one great family office commit to us when we were in Philly, and we had one great fund of funds commit to us when we were in New York. And that was the extent of that second close, basically.
Crazy.
So we sent out an LP meeting in the middle of March. So normally these are quarterly and we would send it in April. We sent it out in the middle of March, basically like right after the NBA closed down. It was like,
Rudy
all right.
Gobert. That's our Utah legend there. Rudy was the first one. That was the one.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So we sent out an early LP update. It was basically like, all right, change of strategy. Like, looks like we could just end up having a $30 million fund, but you know, evaluations are going to come down and all this other stuff. And so the strategy is going to shift and it'll be fine. And we thought that was true for at least a couple of weeks. But then obviously, as we all know, the world just totally flipped on its head. And
yeah.
So we had like, so then it was like 6 to 8 weeks of basically like nobody answering our calls. And spending most of that time kind of triaging prior portfolio and kind of like dealing with our existing LPs and answering all their questions around what was going on. But then, you know, by the end of the summer, it was off to the races again. It was like, I think it took us, you know, it took us almost 6 months to get the first like $25 million, 2 months of zero effectively, and then 8 weeks to get the other $50 million.
Wow. So we ended up increasing the size from 60 to 75, which was our hard cap. And
people just decided during the pandemic that fintech mattered. And all of a sudden, all these people that, even people who had kind of passed on us at the beginning of the process because they didn't believe in fintech or didn't think that fintech would justify a standalone seed strategy, just started calling us in like June, July, August. And we're like, hey, we've been looking into this fintech thing. And we hear that you guys are the ones to talk to. And so we got super lucky. Like that, the tail end of that fundraise just went like wildfire.
Yeah, I think it's, like Jake said, fintech started becoming more of a thing. Undeniably that the interest rates were lower and money printer was going.
So it was.
And then I think we had gotten a little bit more credibility even into that summer.
We had a portfolio at that point. We were still making investments during all of this. We could actually point to all of these and tell the story.
You talked about not even wanting to raise a fund until you could actually talk about why you were different. So when you're going into these meetings, what are you telling them? Why is this going to be different? And I can take some guesses. It's like, hey, we understand fintechs. We actually kind of think we know where this is going. So you talk infrastructure and stuff like that.
Exactly.
You talk about your experience actually helping businesses go from zero to one. But tell us a little bit about what you were pitching is a differentiator.
You just sold it.
Okay. Because that's what would get me excited.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, go ahead.
So I'll say exactly what you just said. But also, despite fintech being a huge important category, financial services being 20% of global GDP, there actually aren't very many, if any, fintech focused funds at the seed stage that lead rounds.
Mm-hmm.
And like there's a lot of follow on capital. There aren't many that lead rounds. And we thought there was an opportunity to differentiate and be that, setting the price, leading the rounds, being super, super active with the companies, and having founder background that is able to help companies at that stage and be empathetic in the right ways.
Cool.
And then that's a differentiator for the founders too. It's like, who wouldn't want the expertise in the cap table, on the board, like all those kinds of things. So you also have that pull from the founders that's going to be a differentiator too, right?
Yeah. And I think not only were there just not a lot of funds doing this, but even of the people that were out there doing early stage fintech investing, you could probably count on less than one hand those who had experience working in financial services, had built fintech companies, and had invested in as many fintech companies as we had. So across my angel portfolio, I probably backed 50 or 60 fintech companies. We had like 80 something out of 500 fintech. Like we'd done a lot and done it over since before most were even looking at this as a standalone category. And then, that resonated well with the founders, and then our operational work and just the way that we like to really lean in and be involved in these companies meant that like that reputation with the founders kind of compounded.
What does that usually look like? Because there's this spectrum, right? Of like, I write a check and I never talk to you again versus like we're all up in your business, we're micromanaging things. So when you talk about being able to be involved.
Adding value.
Adding value.
The bot, yeah. One of our portfolio companies, or actually a couple of our portfolio companies, say that they claim that we've written a bot that represents us because we respond so fast, and some of the other investors like don't respond in a timely fashion, if at all.
Yep.
But I think we pride ourselves on like having a quick response SLA, in some cases, no matter where we are in the world or no matter what time it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because like being on the other side of it, like that really matters. And I think we try to have a close relationship with founders, but your question was like, how do you engage?
Yeah.
And it depends company to company. It's sometimes a function of what they want mixed with what we want, but usually we have a regular touch point, early on could be biweekly, later it becomes monthly and then can be ad hoc and just boards.
Yeah.
But there's some regular touch point. I think one thing we try to impress upon them is like, there's nothing they can't reach out to us about, like, and no question too dumb, too small, whatever. Yeah. We're always there. And I think that's really important.
We've talked to a bunch of founders, both at Pelion and Angel Investment. And when you ask them, what they value most in investors. It's like when I get a text from him or her, I actually like opening and reading the text. It sounds like that's one of the main things you're offering to founders, is like they like working with you because you've done it before. Is that fair?
And how do you square that with the fact that sometimes you're having to be the voice of reason, yeah. having a hard combo? Yeah. How do you balance that?
It's funny. So every VC will tell you their value add, or they work closely with founders or whatever. And so I think when things are relatively easy, like it's easy to pretend like you're a value add. But I think that we're some of the areas where we've kind of set ourselves apart. Like I was just meeting with a founder earlier today, and we were talking about monthly investor updates, and he pointed out that I was the only investor that ever read his investor updates. And I'm not the only VC on his cap table. So like just basic things like that set us apart. I think we've had a number of companies throughout our investing careers who have had to shut down or get acqui-hired or you know, they had founder breakups or whatever. We've seen kind of all of the trials and tribulations mm-hmm. also. And in many of those cases, we were the only ones still answering the phone when the founders needed something, you know, helping them work through the acqui-hire, helping them shut down the company, talking them off the cliff in some cases. Like we've definitely had the conversation of, you know, it's, you know, this happens all the time. Like it's nothing to be ashamed of to close a company down. Just take care of yourself, take care of your employees. Don't worry about us. Like a lot of these founders just feel bad. Like they have to return our capital to us or something. And they'll like kill themselves trying to make that happen. And, you know, we have to keep pointing out that like, if you give us 1x, half X or 0x of our money back, it doesn't make a difference. Like first and foremost, take care of your team, then take care of yourself, and then worry about us last. And so having those sorts of conversations, I think has really kind of helped set us apart. And then in terms of like having those hard conversations, like one of the things you learn as an entrepreneur and as a founder is that sometimes the most empathetic thing you can do for somebody, like the kindest thing you can do for somebody, is just tell them the truth.
Yep.
Like we're all adults, and especially like smart, talented adults kind of tend to know when you're bullshitting them or kind of know when things aren't going well. We've got a radar
for it. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the key is just, you know, you're not insulting them or you're not saying anything bad about them. You know, there's just a process that needs to be questioned, or there's like a decision making that needs to be questioned or something, and kind of pushing and pulling accordingly. You know, we've had to do plenty of that as well.
Makes sense. So you guys brought it up, and I think, you know, Sterling and I debate a little of like, what's the main golden nuggets that these guests might have? And for you two, it's no surprise. It's like, we're talking to two of the fintech experts in all of VC. And so we want to cover some topics in fintech. You brought up this idea of it was easier to fundraise because the hype cycle of fintech was very strong. We've now come down the other side.
Yeah.
Where fintech is demolished. NerdWallet's trading at around
its revenue. It used to get software multiples. It doesn't have software margins. You know, like now the other shoe, right?
So let's talk about that. Like, what's your assessment of where fintech's at today? Are you bullish? Are you bearish? I mean, obviously you're bullish, but like, what's it going to look like in the future? Is it going to go back to somewhere in the middle, or are we at a new normal and this is it? What do you think?
You want to go? Yeah, I think, I mean, economically speaking, and just in terms of the venture industry as a whole, in terms of the startup industry as a whole, I mean, I tend to think that we're in a new normal. And I also tend to think that like, even if we're not, you should just operate like we are.
Yeah.
Like there's no point in trying to hope that this is going to end and things are going to go back.
To bet on something to get better.
Yeah. Exactly. Now our view on kind of the hype cycle surrounding fintech is just that like, you know, we were able to, to some extent, like benefit from that for our own fundraising. Sure. But at the same time, we weren't turning around and dumping our capital into like those hypey themes. We've kind of always taken the approach that a lot of these business models that people got really happy about in fintech are things that the incumbents, at least here in the US, have largely already won. And they tend to be games of marketing spend and cost of capital at the end of the day, which are not games that you can win as a venture-backed company. And if you are winning, that's probably a bad sign. Like if you're a consumer unsecured lender and you're growing like a consumer social network, like you're probably doing something wrong. So, you know, the hype cycle kind of comes and goes, but it tends to follow like certain aspects of fintech. And this happened actually when we were starting our career as well. That's when like the robo advisors all plateaued. We had the first generation of lenders all go public and shit the bed.
Yep.
We had like the very beginnings of the like neobank world, but that hadn't really like kind of started out yet, or the, I'd say like Simple didn't really work out, and then Chime had only just started. And so we'd already had one kind of hype cycle that we lived through in like the those days of fintech, and then we just kind of watched it play out again. But our thesis for the fund, for Fund One and Fund Two, was exactly the same, and the stuff that we've been investing in is largely the same, and it tends not to be the stuff that's attracting the most hype and the most capital, at least not in the early stages. We hope that they attract a little bit more capital in the later stages, but so our view has just been like, you know, at a high level, this is a Shiel reference, like a huge portion of global GDP. You can't convince me that we're done innovating in technology in this space if you've ever tried to like send somebody money or send money overseas, or if you're a business and you've ever tried to like pay a bill, as you all know, very well, these are not all solved problems. And that's just, you know, scratching the surface. There's financial services covers, you know, a dozen different industries. So,
okay. So you mentioned that if you're relying on like cost of capital arbitrage and like paid ads, you're probably not sustainable. But where do you see opportunities in fintech? Where do you look for, what do you look for in a good fintech space or bet? And how do you determine what's good versus not?
I mean, there are businesses that you don't need to spend as much money to acquire those early customers. There aren't enough of them to fill a portfolio with. So to a certain extent, you are, you know, you do have to rely on some paid, especially if you're investing in consumer. But I think there are businesses that have some sort of data advantage or some sort of distribution advantage. And so like in lending or insurance, that can lead to better underwriting and distribution. Other businesses are sort of behind the scenes, what we call embedded fintech. And we've invested a lot behind this thesis that somebody else is doing the distribution and you're servicing them with a fintech product. So examples in our portfolio, Unit does that for banking. So an example customer is like Toast, a restaurant POS system.
I think Sace is built on Unit.
Sace is built on Unit, yes. A lot of their new customers are vertical SaaS businesses. So, you know, Toast is the platform that restaurant owner uses to manage their business. And they might as well manage their finances in there too. They're already accepting payments, doing other stuff, managing payroll. So it makes sense that they would also do banking through it. We have another company called Salsa that's a payroll as a service company, sells into a similar customer set. And then a recent portfolio company called Layer that automates accounting.
It's a Wealthfront guy, I know him.
Yeah, exactly. automates accounting for the same segment. So
one theme, a very strong, seems to be embeddable finance. Fair
exactly.
to say? Okay.
Yeah.
What other big ones would you say? Or keep going on the embeddable one if you've got more to say there, Jake.
Yeah, the viewpoint there, and you know, this still needs to be proven out, but the viewpoint there is that like financial services in the past were kind of commodity products all being sold out of very specific brick and mortar sort of institutions, right? And so like savings accounts, checking accounts, all these things all lived inside of a bank and they were all effectively the same. I like to joke that like banks are effectively like used car lots, and you have one bank over here selling gray Honda Accords and another bank over here selling like gray Toyota Corollas, right? And they're both spending a bunch of money to tell you that theirs is the best, but they're the exact same car. And that's kind of the world that we grew up in, is like where financial products were like very siloed within these organizations. But a lot of that had to do with the fact that, you know, these aren't software businesses. Like in a world where we all live online, everything's done in software, we're all on our phones all the time, that doesn't make sense anymore, that paradigm. And so the idea is that like these financial products are going to start to disperse through the rest of the software world and throughout the internet and kind of show up wherever you need it, in whichever kind of software platform you happen to be using, with like Toast and Shopify and some of these companies being the canonical examples. And so a lot of what we're enabling, or what we're trying to invest behind, is that the future of financial services is not going to be the end user experiences, the business models, and just the overall like product experiences are not going to be the same as what they were in the past. And it starts with the underlying infrastructure and then eventually the kind of application layer. Yeah.
What do you think of interchange businesses? Can you build a business on interchange anymore, or you think that's dead?
I don't know if you saw.
I did the debit chain interchange.
Yeah, I mean, for those in the audience who don't know, a lot of fintech, especially neobank business models, are built on interchange. which is the amount you get when somebody swipes a debit or credit card. And a lot of this arbitrage has existed because from the Card Act, there was a Durbin Amendment that regulated how much banks can make off of debit interchange, but it exempted banks below $10 billion in assets. So every company that you know of, Divvy, Chime, and others are built on these smaller banks and are taking advantage of that arbitrage where you get an extra almost point and a half compared to what the big banks get. And if that gets regulated away, that makes life a lot tougher for a lot of these businesses.
Yep.
And I think it's best to imagine that that is going to go away at some point, whether or not it's this new announcement. And I'm sure it's going to take a long time to work its way through. There's going to be lawsuits, all sorts of stuff. But it's best to assume that that interchange model is not going to be as lucrative as it once was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's fair. You're saying don't even take a bet on the actual legislation. Just act like something will take that away and build a real business independent of interchange.
It's like if everybody drops 150 basis points, then what allows you to have more pricing power than the next person, right?
That's
what
right.
allows you to have more value and more defensibility there, which is the right way to operate.
And ultimately, like when the Durbin Amendment came into place, like that didn't actually change bank profits. Mm-hmm. What ended up happening was
you changed the profit pools.
That's
profit
right. pools. Yeah. And at the time, I think it was like 80% of bank checking was free, and now it's like 45% of yep. checking is free.
Yep.
So they found a different way to make money. But what has happened now is the Durbin Amendment gave real power to the startups.
Yeah.
And, you know, startups have a huge advantage over the established banks that may not last.
It's funny. Speaking of like the bank profit pools moving, another fun NerdWallet content strategy story from the early days is so back in 2009-10, you know, all these different consumer regulations were coming out, the Card Act, the Durbin Amendment, all this stuff. And we were some of the only people that were writing like in-depth content about what these things meant. And not just, you know, the rest of the press was just kind of like regurgitating
yeah.
kind of what was happening. My co-founder Tim had previously been an equity research analyst in the hedge fund world, studying the business models of banks and credit card processors and stuff. And so he put together all this content that was basically like, you know, the Card Act is going to get rid of these fees, but that just means that banks are going to do this over here. And so we wrote a long thing about the Durbin Amendment, specifically about how if you get rid of, or if you cap interchange fees, that means that debit card rewards, because that used to be a thing, you used yeah. to earn rewards on your debit spend. Debit card rewards are going to go away. Like all these other fees are going to pop up in checking accounts and all this other stuff. Hmm. And of course, nobody cared initially. But then when the Durbin Amendment went live, Chase sent out millions of letters to all their customers that said, because of the Durbin Amendment, we're getting rid of your debit card rewards, effective blah, blah, blah. And so a gazillion people rushed onto the internet that day and Googled Durbin Amendment.
And you won that day.
Yeah.
That was a good
and
day
that
for
actually
Nerd
turned
Wallet.
Out to like, we got, because of all the traffic to that website, first from being there first and kind of ranking number one, like all the journalists started linking to us, all these other websites started linking to us. And that played out for years. Like we were probably still getting in links to that page for 4 years after that or something.
So we have a couple questions we ask everybody as we're kind of wrapping up. Who's an operator you admire and who's an investor you admire? And then Tyler will ask the last one. But for both of you, who's an operator you admire and who's an investor you admire?
For me, operator, I mean, there are a bunch of folks in our portfolio that I admire, but I know that that's cheating.
That's cheating, absolutely.
So outside of the portfolio, I love reading Parker Conrad and when and listening.
He's
to
the most.
Everybody and, says that.
By the
it's,
way,
it's
like,
hilarious.
Think,
everyone says it. And
I think
it's
the right answer.
Yeah.
So it's
okay.
It's,
yeah.
No,
just
it's
a basic.
A good,
no,
I, I think you're
trying
right.
Trying to be controversial over
yeah,
here.
Yeah, damn it. All right. I get this one.
Okay, Parker Conrad. I like it.
Okay. Jake, what do you got?
I'm going to poke at you guys a little bit. I love Eric at Ramp.
Oh, going for the portfolio.
Hey.
That
was a great
well, it was
portfolio
a
choice.
It was a fun episode. See you guys. <He's>,
So obviously, like that company is just, they're a great magnet for talent. Like they have an incredible sense of urgency. They ship product just constantly. And he's just like the sweetest, nicest guy in the world.
Could have fooled me.
Yeah. I'm sure the anger translator, like the Obama anger translator from Key and Peele. I'm sure Eric probably has one of those. Somebody that's out there knifing people for him, but yeah.
Okay, great choices. How about investor?
I think there are a lot of people I love learning from and reading about.
Shiel.
Yeah, it's myself. I'm the best.
That's the most common answer.
I think Bill Gurley. I enjoy reading. Obviously, it's hard to beat his track record. I think there are things to learn that he does super well, things to learn from that like some people don't like. But I've learned a lot just reading about him and from him.
Okay.
We were talking about this at Can't Beat TV this past weekend, Hunter and Satya at Homebrew.
Yeah.
Also just like killer executors, amazing portfolio, nicest guys in the world.
Yeah.
And I love what they did where they hung up their
won their Spurs, and then they're doing their next. They hung them up.
And so on that same page is Roger Ehrenberg.
Yeah, yeah.
Same deal.
Isn't he phenomenal? We got to get him on the podcast.
The Homebrew and IA, they couple things. Look, they got market timing super right. Like came up at the best time, but also they just like executed so well. So many amazing companies they backed. So we both love both of them.
And a lot of respect for anybody that, you know, even, you know, not to discount like how well they did, know that like, you know, they had a lot of tailwinds and, you know, they don't want to keep getting bigger and do what kind of the natural progression is, just like, you know, take your winnings and go home.
Yep. Absolutely. All right. Last one that I've got is, I call it the Golden Spur question. What is it that drives you? Why are you guys the way that you are? What kind of childhood trauma? Why are you the way that you are? Jake, why don't you go first?
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned childhood trauma. I'm not going to go into any details, but did not have the easiest.
Another whole podcast.
Yeah. That. Yeah. Did not have the easiest childhood. And, you know, I kind of referenced before that a lot of my entrepreneurial ambition and just a lot of my ambition in general came from just wanting to get the hell out of Atlanta and kind of wanting to get away from the world I grew up in. And that's a big part of it. I mean, some of my formative memories, actually, I think I was probably like 5 years old. It was like walking into my mom's bedroom at night and she's like sitting there in the dark crying cause she can't afford to pay her bills. And so that taught me at a very early age that like money is the root of all problems. And like, you have to have a lot of money if you don't want to have problems. It's a very kind of childish way to think about it, but that's like, that drove me for a long time. And I think, Now that I'm a bit older and I have kids and everything, and I'm not, you know, existentially worried about money, it's still important to me to like work hard and be successful in things. But I think what I've kind of gravitated towards more recently and the reason like the fund really resonates with me and everything is that I actually want to kind of build communities and kind of pay it forward and help others. And I know that in this business I can do that and be rewarded for it.
It's funny as you said that. You know what I thought of? That sounds like NerdWallet. Build a community, pay forward knowledge. It's funny how startups are just the expression
of
the
founder. It's a win-win. Mm-hmm. It's a mutually beneficial thing, right?
That's why I got involved in angel investing, and then starting a fund was really my way to like kind of have some accountability around that and level up.
Shiel?
Yeah, I think the same is true for both of us in some ways. Like, we're just doing what we love doing. I love helping founders at the earliest stages. It's part of the reason we wanted to start an accelerator is like you get even earlier. They're working out of your office. You're helping them not make the mistakes that you made, and that's just awesome and super fun. I think from a like worldview perspective, I've always been like, as a kid, any like obstacle course, strategy game, any sort of that thing, like I was going to win it. Even though I'm like the smallest kid, I'd always be out there like wanting to win. And I think in the world of venture, like I still have that. I still have that drive. And the thing with venture is like, if you win, there's one output and it's money. So like, that's not my motivation. My motivation is like, winning, but it happens to be that that
scoreboard.
That is the scoreboard. Yeah.
It's funny because somebody asked us in like an AMA. Actually, we asked each other in an AMA years ago. They made us interview each other. Like, if you were an animal, what would you be or something? And I think Shiel said monkey because he's solving all the problems and kind of, you know, going through all the obstacles and whatnot. And I said shark because when, you know, there's this myth that if sharks stop moving, they die. And
you're always moving.
Always moving.
Jake and Shiel, this is awesome. Thanks for taking the time. And real quick plug, we didn't get a chance to talk much about the Mint, but anyone who's listening, who's thinking of building a fintech business, should check out the accelerator that BTV launched in the last year. Sterling and I have met with a bunch of the founders. We love helping out.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks again for the time, guys. This was a blast.
Yeah.
Thank you guys. This is fun.
It's awesome.
So, biggest takeaways from talking with Shiel and Jake?
So a couple things I loved about the convo is it's really easy to weave in these stories of them co-founding a fund and also investing. So they're, you know, they're a really good combination of the investor and operator. Love that. Specifically, I love the insights on fintech, where they're seeing some ideas in embeddable finance and not to rely on interchange. I think that's their big debates for fintech founders. What else? What am I missing?
I loved the stories around that early stage scrappiness that they lived multiple times, and then they got to bring that to a fund and to an accelerator and to all of those kinds of things. Comment that stands out is they say the founders who do whatever it takes are the ones who make it. And taking up smoking to get a customer is pretty great.
I think that's probably the theme, is do whatever it takes, including having to fundraise during COVID, and then it ends up working out. And so much of this game as a startup or an investor is I think we'll talk about Henry in another episode, but you stay alive long enough for something good to happen. And they had that with the fund.
I also think it's really interesting when people are so deep on a specific thing, whatever that thing is. For Jake and Shiel, it's obviously fintech and payments, lending, infrastructure, and all these different kinds of things. But there really are superpowers, and they've been able to predict for their startups where industries were going, but now for their fund where markets are headed and stuff like that, which I think is a superpower.
I think one of my last ones is the importance of finding a good partner. I mean, these two you can tell are on the same page. They're aligned both at the thesis level, but principles, like they act and think very similarly, even though they're both very different people. And when you find the right partner, either as a co-founder or co-investors, you can do some pretty special things, like raise several hundred million dollars in 2 or 3 years, which is what they've done now.
Absolutely.